We're going to bring in David Terechuk now with the Media Beat. David joins us on a weekly basis here on a Friday. David has his own website, themediabeat.us. He's also a PBS television correspondent reporting on ethics and belief. And I always like this time when David is in a foreign land, not in the United States, and he gets to have that unique, different look at what's going on. Good morning, David.
Well, hello there. I'm glad to be reporting in again, but this time from Europe, not from my usual base of New York City, the media capital of the world. But I'm in Dublin, one of Europe's main capital cities. To be honest, Marshall, I could say that Dublin has its own claim to be a media capital, since so many digital media companies have their international headquarters here nowadays. There's unhappy testimony to that fact in recent days because of Twitter and Facebook's severe cutbacks in their labor forces that we've been reading about in the States. And they've hit hard in this city, both of those companies have situated their European HQ in this city. And according to anonymous sources who've been speaking to the Irish Times, at European Twitter, under Elon Musk's heavy new hand, it's a case of human resources carnage, that's the word being used, with the mass layoffs looking quote, random and indiscriminate here in Dublin's fair city. The impact is being felt over here very seriously.
You know, I think people tend to lose sight of that these companies, Twitter and Facebook and stuff, are international companies, and the thousands of people they employ are not just in this country, but they are across the world. And when you have a company that lays off more than 50%, and it's a worldwide company, more than 50% of its staff, possibly as high as 70%, you know, you talk about a world economy, that has a huge effect. And when you have an industry that is going through that, it really has an effect on the world economy, and not just a short term, but a potentially long term one.
Sure, I mean, look around this city, and we mentioned Twitter and Facebook, but there's also Google and other big digital names, well known digital names all over this city. And there's something particularly helpful about Ireland as a European outpost for companies that may well have started in California. I mean, they speak English for a start, but also it's now getting a certain inevitable leg up in terms of its overall attractiveness as a place for facing European operations, because of course Britain, which you might have thought would qualify, is sort of discounting itself in the post-Brexit era, because of course it's no longer part and parcel of the European package. It's just no longer European. So Ireland has that advantage. It actually is European, and it's fully plugged into the European community. So inevitably, big American companies will find it very congenial, and they do. But of course, they're now retrenching, and so Ireland has to take, I was going to say, its fair share, probably more than its fair share, of the negative side of retrenchment. And that's exactly what's happening. It's certainly most pointedly at Twitter, but that's the case in California too. I mean, what's happening in San Francisco seems particularly weird and strange, with Elon Musk apparently now shutting the doors of the company until next week. It's in essence a classic employer's lockout, but quite why it's happening doesn't seem at all clear.
Pretty amazing stories, and as we talk about these stories that you're talking about, you get that great view from afar, expert from afar now, because you're speaking from not America, and you're getting not only the news that you get, but you also get the reaction of the people that you're around over there. And I was wondering, in the United States, already some of the really, really conservative, not I don't even call them conservative, the real far wing of the Republican Party are potentially going to try in the House to cut funding for the United States helping out what's going on in Ukraine. What's the view over there that you see and hear from people?
Well, it's been interesting. I mean, at governmental, at least, overall, the mood here, I mean, here in general, in Europe, about American leadership has actually gotten better. The journalistic media, anyway, are reporting that European national governments are breathing sighs of relief in the aftermath of the U.S. Midterm elections. They clearly believe that the slimmer margins of control now to be our forthcoming landscape for next year between Democrats and Republicans in Congress will not jeopardize American support for Ukraine as the Russian aggression continues and that war so horribly carries on with those appalling attacks on the civilian infrastructure of Ukraine. That's all of it, of course, a critical matter for Europeans, understandably. The trouble is we can't be totally sure that their confidence is well-placed. Republican control of the House of Representatives, I mean, it's definite now, but it's going to be slim, and it may be slim but in number of seats, but it could still be subject to that growing desire that you mentioned among that old familiar isolationist wing of the GOP, if you like, to stop giving the Ukrainians what we have to acknowledge. The new Speaker of the House, Kevin McCarthy, for it will be him, will it not? What he's infamously called a blank check to the Ukrainian for the Ukrainians. That's how some Republicans think about American support for the Ukrainians' valiant effort against Russia, giving them a blank check. What's interesting, it's certainly been very clear in the European media that one very influential Ukrainian diplomat, Yevgeny Kornichuk, he's the country's ambassador to Israel, in fact, has been saying to various press outlets that Kiev is watching very closely, that was the term he used, and what he calls the minority of pro-Trump Republicans, because his government, the Ukrainian government, is concerned that they, the Trumpists, are not really happy with support for Ukraine. And that, of course, saddens and worries the Ukrainians and, of course, all its supporters in Europe. And, of course, he could be right, I guess.
You know, we have to get to Donald Trump for a second. He made his announcement that he's going to run for president. And I don't know if you saw the headline in the Murdoch-owned papers. Did you see that headline that they put in?
Well, I know that Murdoch is no longer supporting Trump, so I imagine the headlines are not the kindly ones that they used to be.
It wasn't.
And we talked last week about how nasty they could be.
Yeah,
what have they got to now? Do you tell me?
Okay, well, out of the whole front page, the bottom maybe 4 inches of the bottom of the front page, the headline said, Florida Man Makes Announcement.
I'm flabbergasted, as you can hear, but I'm not really. I'm not at all surprised. What is perhaps surprising is that the Murdoch paper could be capable of such clever subtlety. Well, most of the European press, relieved though they may be about the overall result of the midterms, they seem as if they can't quite get over the relatively poor electoral showing, and that's probably to be blamed on Trump himself. But the Republicans' poor electoral showing has gotten the Europeans very puzzled. And the puzzlement has united both left and right. The French leftist newspaper, Libération, expressed astonishment that, quote, the results of the midterm elections are much less bad than feared for the Democrats, and that there was, quote, no Republican tsunami after all. I mean, that's echoing a lot of American coverage, of course. And Bild, Germany's right-wing tabloid, was utterly incredulous and with some severe judgmental annoyance. It started listing all the factors that had favored the Republicans and should have helped them to do a lot better. Inflation, an uncertain economy, immigrants surging in from the South, as Bild sees it, and seriously low approval ratings for the Democratic president, of course. And Bild's editorialists proclaimed themselves to be der Wunder, which is a terrific German word that probably translates best as a mixture of amazement and bewilderment. So, yeah, they're a little... of course, and that goes for a lot of Europeans. And they're bemused, too, by the fact that Trump is coming around again for a run. I think not many of them seem to be taking it all that seriously, but we'll see as we get towards 2024 how they take the prospects of a Trump run. I suspect they're going to get as agitated as they were in 2016.
All right, I want to bring up MBS, the Saudi leader. He got immunity from the United States over the murder of the journalist, which seems like it happened just yesterday. I was wondering if there was any reaction to that. That's a story that just broke yesterday.
Oh, there has been reaction. There certainly has. I mean, it's vying perhaps for some of the worst news, along with the terrible repression and mass murder going on in Iran at the moment. But it's an announcement, effectively, that's come from the United States administration this time. And as I say, it's sort of vying for place as the worst news of the week. It's a decision by the United States State Department announced during a court case against the administration that Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman of Saudi Arabia, because he's now Prime Minister as well as Crown Prince, is immune from international prosecution. In the case of the Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi's murder and dismemberment, let's not forget that the case in federal court is being pursued by Khashoggi's fiance Hatice Cengiz and the human rights organization that the couple formed together called Dawn. The Crown Prince is, of course, claiming immunity. What is in fact called sovereign immunity, because he's effectively the country's leader, the head of government, that entitles him to diplomatic immunity on a grand scale, sovereign scale, in fact. And Dawn's chief executive, in succession to Khashoggi himself, Sarah Leah Whitson, is now in charge of Jamal's foundation. She said, it's impossible to read the Biden administration's move as anything more than a capitulation to Saudi pressure tactics, including slashing oil output, in order to twist America's arm and recognize the MBS, bin Salman's fake immunity ploy. Well, you know my views on the inexcusable administration position on Saudi Arabia in this journalist-killing outrage. Let's put it down to just another instance of official wriggling and evasion of responsibility. It's simply unacceptable. And in terms of how the Europeans are covering it, yes, it's universal, certainly in the realm of the media, because, of course, we're bound to be totally outraged by it. This is you know, a representative of the Fifth Estate. Press freedom is a horrible, sick joke in the context of a government leader being allowed to kill and dismember a journalist simply doing his work. So, yeah, as I say, you know about my feelings in this case.
And there's another case which is going to ride the headlines, and that involves Russia and their merchant of death. Russia obviously trying to swap the merchant of death to get him out of the United States with the United States basketball player. I mean, that is now on the front burner again.
Yeah, but the sad case of the female basket player who's only offense, and it wouldn't be an offense anywhere in many other countries, though of course there are some countries where it is an offense to have inadvertently, she says, packed in her luggage medically necessary marijuana oil, and that's deemed worthy of imprisonment in a Russian penal colony. And her release, or swapping at least, along with another United States citizen, for a notorious arms dealer, is the overall deal package that is being discussed. I mean, it's cynical and an outrage, of course, that these are the sort of equivalences that are considered in deal making between two major nations of the world when they're trying to come to a deal about individuals. In both the United States citizens' case, it's perfectly justifiable to argue that they're unjustifiably detained or imprisoned. There's very little doubt in one case, and the balance is also in the same direction for the other case. But to consider that the two of them are somehow worth in moral, legal terms, to be in some way an equivalent of, as I say, a notorious arms dealer, smuggler, in fact. That's a sad case of governmental amorality. But on the other hand, all these package deals have a smack about them of unfairness. No clear human equity about it at all. And of course, in the case of the American State Department, in this case with the American State Department, you get the very strong sense that what comes first is the perfectly understandable desire to get American citizens out of an unjustifiable situation. And that's been done time and time again in the past, and one trusts that it's going to be the outcome finally, whatever else is done to sweeten the deal by the Americans, because clearly they're under pressure to sweeten it more for the Russians. And we hope to have two American citizens on their way home before too long. It has already been too long in many ways, of course, but now the deal is possibly in sight.
All right, we're speaking with David Tarachuk. Of course, it's the Media Beat. I know how it reverberated here. I know how it reverberated with me, where my eyes went wide open. What's the European reaction to that missile being shot down, obviously, by the Ukrainians, and then landing in Poland, killing people? I mean, did that kind of rattle cages? And I think what it shows...
Rattle is the right word. There was a shudder, universal shudder throughout Europe, because suddenly, of course, we had a NATO member. Poland is a member of NATO. On its territory, a missile lands, and there are fatalities. Not many, but one is enough. One human being lost, and you know the the essential agreement upon which NATO is founded, that an attack on one NATO state is regarded as an attack on the entire alliance. And that could trigger an escalation of the Russia-Ukraine war, initiated, of course, by sheer and outright aggression by the Russians, would take on a whole new dimension. Now, that's not happening. I mean, everyone's effort, everyone involved, from the NATO Secretary General sideways, has been to damp down the possibility of escalation. Now it's looking as if, the most likely explanation is that it's Ukraine's own defense system in response to the hideous bombardment against civilian targets of Russian missiles and rockets, and some drones as well, is what could be responsible. A Soviet-made, in fact, it's that old, it's from that era, Soviet-made missile fired by Ukrainians may well have been what ended up landing in and causing the terrible and unacceptable fatalities in Poland. But that's one of those classic instances of unwished for collateral in a war. And that seems to be the way that it's going to be left. Although the Ukrainians themselves, in the person of President Zelensky, it's being firmly claimed by the Ukrainians themselves that it's not theirs, that it wasn't theirs, and you can't prove that it is ours. Is the claim from the Ukrainians? It's going to be shrouded in a continual way, I think, in the fog of war. But at least, I hope I'm not being too cynical in saying this, but at least it sort of dampens down the fears of the kind of escalation that nobody wants, and that's how it's being left now, at least for the moment.
Well, what it shows to me, and how lucky we are that we didn't give up. We didn't give up on NATO. And it shows that everything that Vladimir Putin has done to destroy the unity of NATO has backfired since this war in Ukraine. And it shows that the Biden administration's immediate shoring up of our relations with our European allies and NATO really was a very, very important step of what's gone on in the past 2 years.
Yeah, and along with that strengthening of NATO's own nation-to-nation ties, is that there's also a confidence to their position now that enables them to not have a knee-jerk reaction when something like this happens. They've got a solid, they've been solid throughout the response to the invasion, although it's solid in the sense that they're not going to war, but they are taking all the necessary supportive steps on the side of Ukraine. And there are, of course, individual members of NATO that are not as enthusiastic as the others about supporting Ukraine. But nonetheless, the overall position of the alliance is pretty damn clear, and I think, in a somewhat ironic boomeranging kind of way, Putin himself is responsible for that solidity in the alliance that he's always demonized as the major threat to Russia. It's kind of ironic, but in a way, well earned.
And finally, I have to ask this question. The big explosion here in the United States with FTX, its bankruptcy, and the billions of dollars worldwide, it is affected with, once again, an unregulated crypto industry. That has gone from not only being a United States problem, but it must be viewed as a big problem in Europe as well.
Oh, sure, yeah, and for many people, of course, it's confirmation of the fact that dealing in cryptocurrencies, bitcoins included, and all the other various oddly named currencies also, is long overdue. And one of the current thoughts gaining ground in the European business press is that cryptocurrency ought to be brought into the same kind of remits of regulation and vigilant overseeing by national banks, or if necessary, a parallel organization that is at least expert and fully equipped and knowledgeable about the trade dealings in these currencies to just establish the same degree of wise oversight. And how that's going to be affected is hard to tell, but the groundswell of opinion in favor of some greater form of regulation, so we don't get ourselves into such horrific runs on a particular institution, because this is what it was a good old-fashioned run on a bank, everyone demanding out of the bank involved, where is our money? Like one of those scenes from a frontier type western, and preventing that from happening again is not beyond the wit of good business oriented institutions, and that's what inevitably is going to develop out of this, I think, some kind of well-defined and purposeful pressure to get institutional oversight again. There was some hint of it when this whole market started up in the first place, and then it was dismissed as being a fuddy-duddy kind of nannying, which was not necessary. But I think oversight is definitely required in the wake of this disaster. And it's probably what we're going to get. Not immediately, probably, but in good time.
It amazes me, as we look back in history, David, that the old saying, if you don't learn from history, you're bound to repeat it. We can go back to the dot-com collapse. We can go back to the banking collapse at the end of the Bush administration. We can go back now to the second mortgage crisis that's going on. And now this. It just seems these smart people that are involved in these high-end worldwide businesses that everything that happens with them affects the whole world, it just seems they never learn.
Yep, and you could go back in history too to the Teapot Dome scandal and the tulip gold rush at Amsterdam in the 17th century. Human greed is always at work and always needs corrective mechanisms to keep it in check. I guess we're just seeing that old folkloric almost pattern being repeated yet again. And the same sort of well tried and tested measures have to be imposed in the end. In just about every field. We'll see how that one goes.
All right. Well, we'll speak to you next week from afar again, David. Always great to chat with you on the Media Beat.
Absolutely. I look forward to talking to you next week.
And happy Thanksgiving in advance, by the way.
Oh, thank you very much.
Just in case. All right. Take care. David Tarachuk with the Media Beat this morning. You're on the Breakfast Club on Robinhood Radio.